I'm Emma Connors, Managing Editor of The Interpreter, and I'm speaking today with Peter Fever, Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at Duke University in North Carolina. Dr. Fever is an expert on the transition period in US federal politics, that is, the changeover from one president to the next. He also served as a special advisor to the National Security Council in the George W. Bush administration. Dr. Fever, could you please first outline the process of transition and then perhaps discuss some potential features of the handover from President Obama to Donald Trump, soon to be confirmed as president-elect?
Well, critics of the United States have observed that we're one of the only great powers that does a full lobotomy every time we have a transfer in executive power. A significant number of positions in the U.S. executive branch are political appointments. The holders serve at the pleasure of the president, as the chief of staff said to me when I took my position. When the pleasure is gone, so are you. But of course, that when a president changes, that means all of those slots are available to be filled by the new team. And so, on the day of the inauguration at noon, they leave their office and are gone, and all of their positions are filled temporarily by career service, civil service people, but shortly to be filled by political appointees of the new administration. So what the Trump team is doing now is reviewing those rosters, reviewing lists of names of people that they think would match up with them, and trying to assemble the best team of advisors and policymakers and confirmable senior officials that they can assemble.
And it's a fairly lengthy process. I've heard up to 3,000 jobs are in play.
North of 3,000. It is it's a large number of jobs, but it's also a serious review of every one of the departments and agencies. There's a team of staff. The campaign has assembled a team of staff to look at everyone. So one team looking at the State Department, one team looking at the Defense Department, one team looking at Homeland Security, another team at the White House, and so on, reviewing how that department functions and whether they want to have the same organization chart, whether they want to tweak it to streamline it or to give greater emphasis to this or that presidential priority. And then the same thing is being done with an eye to the policies. So what are the current policies regarding each of the major lines of operation of each of the departments? And all of that is being done. Actually, the process began months ago. And by law, it begins actually in late spring, once the two parties have identified who their eventual nominee is going to be. At that point, they set up a transition team, each one does, using office space that the U.S. government provides. The key members of that, the ones that need it, are given security clearances so they can see classified material. And they've been gradually going through this work in the expectation that their side would win. So the loser this time around, Clinton's team, have done an extraordinary amount of work up until now, and it's all, from their point of view, for naught. And the Trump team now shifts into overdrive to accelerate the work they've been doing, because now they know for sure it's for real.
And would the Trump team have already approached people up until the election, or is it generally they wait until they know?
It's a mix of both. And of course, President-elect Trump was a candidate like none other, and so he didn't follow the traditional norms. I'll describe the traditional norms, and then, to the best as I know it, what Trump did. The traditional norm is you assemble a very large list of worthies who sign their name to an endorsement sheet that says, you know, yes, I want this person to do it. So Clinton is a good example. There was a large, long list of people who had endorsed her publicly, written public op-eds endorsing her, and who had formed different policy areas advising her, so one for Syria, one for Iran, one for Africa, one for East Asia, and so on. This list of people was much larger than the list of senior appointments that she could give, and so she was being very careful not to tell which ones she favored, because she wanted them all to be, you know, supporting and rowing in the same direction. And then at this point in the process, had she won, there would be the painful jockeying as the half dozen people who saw themselves as a potential Secretary of State got winnowed down to the one that she was going to pick, and so on for each of these positions. That's the normal way it's done. Trump's case, he had a much leaner policy advisory team than presidential candidates normally have. And so he has, there's a much more urgent task for him to expand his list of potential people he can pick, because we're, in Clinton's case, had the opposite. She had too many, and she was going to have to shrink. In Trump's case, he had a leaner list, and he needs to expand it. But for the senior-most positions, the chief of staff of the White House, the top cabinet officials, those delegate discussions are going on now, and presumably President-elect Trump and his senior-most advisors have already had that conversation with a couple of people, and they're making their determination, and they'll announce that soon. There's a couple complications. You have to be able to get a security clearance. It's not automatic, and so that's one concern. And the other concern is you have to be able to be confirmed by the Senate for most of these positions, and that means you have to pass through a rigorous vetting on financial improprieties, criminal record, scandals in the closet, all of that kind of thing. And so that's a time-intensive and costly process, and it's there have been many cases where a promising candidate sort of stumbled in that vetting process. And if they don't uncover it in the private phase of the vetting and it's revealed in the public phase of the vetting, then it's a real problem for the administration. So they're most presidents-elect go through that scrutiny, subject their team to that scrutiny in very exacting form.
So that means they've got an awful lot of work to do, given that they were less advanced in terms of having a smaller pool of candidates, and what, it's something like 10 weeks to the inauguration?
It is. It's a brutal amount of work. And indeed, because of that, in recent years, about 5 years ago, the U.S. government passed a law that enabled and indeed required candidates to do some of it in advance. It used to be, 20 years ago, it used to be unseemly to do that kind of work before you had won. It was like you're measuring for drapes. How presumptuous of you to think you're going to win. And of course, that makes no sense. It's too important not to be done. And you can't be squeezed into the 10 weeks. And so in the last, over the last decade or so, the norm has shifted, and now you're considered irresponsible if you haven't started earlier. So some of the work has already been done, but you're right. It's an incredible amount of work to be done from now until inauguration. And indeed, because that's just in picking the names, then you have to get them confirmed. That's a slow process as well. In many, many cases, a president's team is not fully formed and in place until even midway through the start of their first year.
Right, okay, so that is quite a time-consuming process, obviously. I happen to be in Washington at the minute, and in a bar I was in last night, I overheard a snatch of conversation, someone talking about the transition team had passed on some of the list. This whole town seems to be consumed with the list at the minute.
Right. It has enormous consequences for people's careers and for their you know, for the kinds of work that they can do. But it matters in another way. In every administration, personnel is policy. So campaign promises are one thing, but the people that you pick to actually implement them, that speaks volumes for what your policies actually will be. And that's true in any administration, but I think it's especially true with an unconventional candidate like President-elect Trump, who did not have, did not publish elaborate position papers that laid out all of his positions, doesn't have a long track record of governing or voting on issues, so we know what his, you know, true policy preferences are. Many, many questions are hanging about the direction he would go on this or that policy, and the answers will be clearer once we know who the people he has picked. And so it's always a matter of great interest in Washington during the post-election phase, but it's especially urgent this time around.
And I think you said earlier that some of those appointments will be announced before Inauguration Day. Is that sort of the form, you know, some of those really top-line important posts?
Well, President-elect Bush, who had an unusual transition period because it wasn't clear that he had been, you know, that he had won until mid-December. So that was a month of delay. You know, the election itself lasted a month longer. So it was unusual in that respect. But it was unusual in another way, which is that he was pretty quick to announce his team, his slate of cabinet appointments. And he had already had a prominent and blue chip team of advisors, the so-called Vulcans. And the only interesting question was who ends up which, you know, in what slots. We knew who the people were, but where they were going to land wasn't so clear. Well, he announced that pretty early on, and that conveyed sort of a sense that he could hit the ground running. At least that was its intention. And so I think there'll be some pressure on the Trump team to do something like that, to name a bunch of his cabinet appointments sooner rather than later. But as we know from his other big personnel choice, namely vice president's choice, he has his own way of doing it. And so that took place somewhat in semi-public as the different candidates went in and were vetted by him and had their audition and you know, you could see them coming and going on TV. And so that was a bit unusual. And so maybe he'll be picking cabinet officials in a similar unusual way.
I'll just ask one final question, which is also slightly historical. Someone I met yesterday commented that there have been more perhaps jarring transitions, they suggested perhaps from President Carter to President Reagan would be one where, you know, everything really was rethought and reconfigured. What's your view in terms of, you know, surprising or dramatic transitions? Will this be one of those?
Well, there's two aspects. One is, well, there's three aspects. One is the policies. Did the policies abruptly reverse themselves? The second is how bloody and acrimonious is the jockeying for position? And third is how well does the incoming team work with the outgoing team? Sometimes the within party transitions on that last point are particularly thorny. So the Reagan to Bush transition was much thornier, bloodier than you might expect, especially since it was the vice president just fleeting up getting a promotion to be president.
Right.
But actually that made it so difficult because he wanted to bring in his own team. that meant he was firing the team he had just been working with. And so many people suspected that if an Obama to Clinton transition could have faced similar problems, a similar acrimony. The Bush to Obama one was remarkably smooth given the level of acrimony in the campaign itself. So Obama campaigned on an anti-Bush platform, but then when it came time to the transition, they worked very well together, and actually President Obama himself praised that just a few days ago when he was announcing his own commitment to do, he said he wanted his team to do at least as well for Trump as Bush had done for him. And so a lot of it has to do with the tone set at the from the very, very top. And then, of course, there's the policy shifts. And they take some time to make clear. And the pattern is that you try to start out with bold shifts, bold swings, but over time the pressure of reality forces people back to sort of a middle ground where the bipartisan consensus on American foreign policy has been. What's interesting is we're not sure whether that'll happen this time. And so that'll be something everyone will be watching. But that will take months to play out. Over the next weeks, the focus will be on the names of the people that get in and the names of the people who get left off. And that's a daily preoccupation in Washington, as you know, if you're there now.
Yeah. Well, I guess, like the rest of the world, we'll all be watching with great interest. Thanks very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.